ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven, and alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
I am Groot.
No, you're Chad Riley.
I am Groot. What if I spent the entire episode only saying that and asking the two of you to translate what you think I mean?
I honestly would probably lose my mind after about like maybe 5-10 minutes of that.
I am Groot.
So, like Chad said, he said the two of you, and that means that we have a special guest. Ladies and gentlemen, we are welcoming back Miss Hannah Porter to the show.
Hey everyone, it's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. What you been up to since you've been gone?
Oh, you know, just taking over the world one step at a time.
There you go. That's legit. Legit here.
That is legit.
Well, The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios in the middle of nowhere, which is apparently the very large head of a very dead ancient celestial, also known as Sacramento, California. Come and get your love with new episodes of The Filmlosophers every Wednesday morning on Libsyn, Audioboom, Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher. Don't limit your experience to just a listen. Engage in a dance-off, bro. Seriously, though, you should definitely connect with us on social media to keep the conversation going. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 for more opportunities to connect.
In particular, Eddie really enjoys dance-offs.
Yes.
And he's very good at them.
Yeah,
that
yes.
is a bold-faced lie, and I'm going to keep going with the notes. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts such as Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I. So we got a great show in store for you today. We're going to be talking about, as Chad already mentioned, The Guardians of the Galaxy.
The first one
in anticipation for the upcoming one, which we're all super excited for. Like, honestly, this film that's coming out, the second one, which is we all already here in this room are planning to go see it come this Thursday.
Already have tickets pre-purchased.
We've already purchased our tickets.
Leave this to chance, folks. Come on.
No. And if you haven't gotten your tickets, shame on you. You need to go get them. Because
we're talking Thursday night tickets.
Absolutely. This is,
yeah, if you're serious, you're serious.
Absolutely.
And if you're not, you're not.
True. That was profound.
Thank you.
So, in terms of this conversation, let's just be honest. This is going to be an awesome next 2 years for Marvel. Not that it hasn't been already prior to this year, but seriously, with Spider-Man Homecoming, Thor Ragnarok, and next year's Black Panther, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Avengers Infinity War, how can you not be stoked? But
I don't know, Eddie. How can you not be stoked?
I'm stoked.
I am Groot.
He's gonna do this. He's gonna do this all day.
I feel like Eddie might end up slapping Chad at some point.
I'm like,
this show. I don't know.
Course.
We'll see.
Have you not been here before?
I have. But you know, it's been a while.
I'm like, I did drive to the studio, so I wonder. Chad, you can get a ride home with Hannah, right?
I am Groot.
So.
I really will stop, but probably not, but maybe.
And at the forefront of this plethora...
Wait, were you still talking? Go on.
Slightly, I think.
I lost the train of thought. How can you not be stoked? I'm reading
notes. Are
you
okay?
It's been a long week already. How can you not be stoked? I don't know. I'm stoked.
And at the forefront of this plethora of incredible cinema is the sequel to one of the most unique and interesting Marvel films to date, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which, like we just mentioned, is debuting in theaters this Thursday. There was a screening for it all over the place these last few weeks, and a lot of critics have gotten a chance to go see it.
It already opened in many markets overseas, mm-hmm. made $100 million over the weekend.
Did very
really?
Well.
Yeah.
Very, very well.
Well, it's no secret to many that the first Guardians of the Galaxy was such an uncertainty when it came to whether this film would be a success. When this film first was talked about, this was one of those conversations where people were like, who? You know, not many people knew about who the Guardians of the Galaxy were, unless you were like Chad, who had a very vast knowledge of, you know, Marvel comics and the stories that were told years ago, because this is based
years
off
ago,
of,
but surprisingly not all that many years ago. The Guardians as they exist here in the movies are not the original version of the comic book Guardians of the Galaxy, minus Yondu, but in the movies, Yondu isn't yet a member of the Guardians. But in the comics, the original team was from the future. Everybody was different. It wasn't the ones that you're used to. This version came about actually in the early 2000s. So they're not all that old as a team. The characters, many of them existed before the early 2000s, but not altogether as the Guardians of the Galaxy. It was a long shot for sure.
Huh. So you're saying Yondu was one of the... He's pretty much the only one that actually is from the original grouping. Kind of little comic
fact here. The original grouping in, what, the 70s or whenever they introduced the concept of the Guardians of the Galaxy, they were from the year 3100 or something ridiculous like that. And Yondu was one of the members of that team. He looked very similar but different. He was an archer. He had a bow and arrow and a big red mohawk, and that's kind of his distinguishing characteristic. And rumor has it that Sylvester Stallone is playing a character in the new film that was also one of the original Guardians from the future. But we'll see if that proves to be true.
Well, so like I said, it's no secret that people were unsure about this film, and even more so about the success of it. So the heroic team that the film was based on was unknown to most, as we said, because Chad had to dig deep into his knowledge of information to kind of gather that. Although you do say it's from a more recent iteration of the Guardians rather than the original iteration.
Yeah, the comics kind of relaunched the what's considered the cosmic element of the Marvel Universe. They have a lot of very powerful characters that live and go through space, and so they have huge power sets. They relaunched the entire Marvel cosmic realm, if you will, in the early 2000s with a crossover maxi series called Annihilation, where you had this race of bug people essentially invading and trying to take over the galaxy, and so various different figures that you had seen previously in Marvel's publishing history had to band together or work solo against these invaders and kind of repel the invasion. The Annihilation Wave is what they called it. And so you had Star-Lord and Drax and Gamora and Rocket Raccoon, Nova, you had Ronan the Accuser, you had a lot of different characters involved in the overall storyline, and a lot of different places that we still haven't seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So apparently, just because they were the more recent incarnation of the Guardians, and quite frankly, they were more current, more relevant in terms of the way that their story was told, the use of humor and quirkiness and all of that, those elements were in place to a certain degree in the comics. So I can see why it was easy for them to translate that iteration of the team into film. Although it wasn't guaranteed to be easy. I mean, a bunch of movie critics were waiting for this to be Marvel Studios' first flop.
Yeah. Well, because another key thing
outside
that...
Outside of Thor 2? I mean...
Didn't Thor 2 come out in 2014 as well?
Maybe.
Yes.
Guardians
2013.
I was going to say, Guardians came out in August. I think that Thor was in November, and I don't think they would have put them that close back then. They put them that close now because they're like, how many can we get into a year?
Well, maybe kind of piggybacking on what Hannah said, maybe the fact that Thor 2 didn't do as well, that it created more of a concern, I guess, for not only just fans but also filmmakers for the Marvel franchise for what Guardians of the Galaxy was going to do. Because, yeah, like I said, another key thing that was regarded in terms of the success or failure was the fact that it wasn't going to have any of the characters that the fans were familiar with in terms of what they've seen with the franchise. It wasn't going to have Iron Man. It wasn't going to have Captain America. It wasn't going to have Thor. It wasn't going to have, you know, any of the mainstays, you know, Black Widow and all that. So this was going to be pretty much an entirely different... It's almost, you could almost say it's almost like an entirely different universe as to what people have
absolutely,
you know, been used to currently. Mm-hmm. So why was it quite possibly one of the best and most successful Marvel films to date? So with all that going against it, one has to ask, you know, what were those deciding factors? What eventually became the reasons why it did so well? So obviously, like we said, it was released at the beginning of the month of August in 2014, and the film grossed over $770 million, making it the fifth most successful Marvel film. That, incorporating the fact, like we said, that it didn't have anybody from the original franchise, it didn't have, you know, it didn't even really have a well-known director at the time. Like, the director at the time was used to doing, you know, small horror films or minor things. The only reason why I was familiar with James Gunn at the time was because I actually had enjoyed his movie Slither prior to that.
Oh man, Slither. Wow. I have not seen that in years.
You've seen it?
Yes, I've seen it, unfortunately.
But you have seen it.
That's impressive. Not many people have. It has Nathan Fillion in it, by the way.
It does, which is pretty much why I've seen it. So...
So we're going to take a closer look.
Do you want to answer that question, or are you rhetorical in this situation?
We are going to answer this question.
Okay.
We, as a group here, are going to answer that question with a closer look, a dissection, if you will, and find out what were some of the aspects of this film that separated it from the rest, ultimately redefining the way franchises are doing comic book films. So let's jump into Guardians of the Galaxy. So
yeah.
Some of the key things that, you know, we want to look at, right off the top, the casting for this film was one of the unique qualities. A lot of people looked at the film and they looked at, okay, one of the stars is going to be Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt was not really anything to look at prior to this. My only, like, experience or even... exposure to who Chris Pratt was pretty much the little bit of Parks and Rec that I had seen.
Sure.
And so to actually see him, well, not only get well into shape, but also be able to fit that particular type of character, because as I said, I had no clue what Star-Lord was like. I didn't know if he was just another Tony Stark in space, or if he was like more like a Captain America, or with whom we've already seen personified on screen. So... that was one of the unique things for me that, in terms of, helped give the film one of those unique aspects to it, is having somebody like Chris Pratt, who's a complete unknown at the time, be their one of their main stars.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way, like, to kind of summarize, and then we can talk about the different elements. But I think one of the big win factors for this film was that kind of giant question mark, you know, that you're like, this James Gunn guy and Chris Pratt, who like got super in shape for the role, and you've got a talking tree and a talking raccoon, and they're in space and they're part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but then not. And the soundtrack is apparently amazing, you know, like
right. All
of it. I think people just got so curious to see if it was seeable. Like, is this something that I should see? Because it has a whole lot of elements that could easily fall apart and not work.
Yeah, it was... I remember even saying when I first saw... or when I first heard the concept of the movie that, what is this? There's talking animals in space. And this is supposed to be good? I was very confused. I didn't really have much context for who the Guardians of the Galaxy were previous to... this film. Mm-hmm. Like, I had heard of them, but I didn't really know much about them. And so this film was really my opening to this part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or just the Marvel Universe in general. And it was the trailer that actually hooked me in. And it was very specific parts of the trailer, for example, the music,
yep. And
how different it was, how they cut the different scenes together in the trailer, and how the characters were portrayed that just immediately I was like, yes, I'm going to go see that. This is going to be fantastic. It's going to be different from anything else that they've done. And that's what I loved about it, was that it was so different from the rest of their films.
Well, and I love that you bring up the trailer, because I mean, nowadays, everybody does their trailers that way. Not everybody, but a lot of films, no matter what genre, they do try to get an interesting song in there to hook you and then, you know, time things to the beat. It didn't start necessarily with the Guardians trailer, but certainly the impact that that trailer had on developing an audience, an interested audience out of potentially nothing into something, got a lot of other films on board with that strategy.
Yep.
Well, and like you said, the impact that it had on other films and in the distant future, I mean, you look at after that, the success of that, the immediate implementation of that in Suicide Squad's trailer and the way they marketed their film similarly to that of Guardians of the Galaxy, it was like they were trying to do ultimately a mirror image of what Guardians had done in terms of the way they structured their marketing plan with the music and everything, but the film didn't kind of match with the atmosphere they were trying to create with the trailers. And likewise, you know, they're DC is also doing it again. Not that it's only DC, because there are other examples, but DC is also doing it again with the Justice League trailer, and how that one has that one song that really kind of has that hook at the end where Batman does his thing towards the end of the trailer. That's another example, but a more recent one that we were talking about not too long ago, and me and Hannah actually mentioned it a while back, is the Thor Ragnarok trailer, which is also utilizing that music composition, making it work with the trailer and the atmosphere of the whole thing.
Well, so, Marvel's taken a page out of their own book with the Thor Ragnarok trailer. I mean, everything down to the 80s, like, writing the title.
Yeah,
and
which
everything
changed midway through production. Like, their artwork for the title changed.
Interesting.
About halfway through filming.
Yeah, because when they had first announced it, it was similar to what they had done before with the Thor films, like very rock, very, you know, stoic looking.
I mean, Ragnarok is the end of the gods. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to have this pseudo final product come out that's fun and funny and bright and colorful and not dreary and, you know, ominous, it's very intriguing that they've taken a different approach than, you know, something that's more end of the world feeling.
But the unique thing, though, is that it actually fits with the way the trailer is going, like the way they're using like the immigrant song, just kind of talking a little bit about on the Thor Ragnarok trailer, the way they utilize that and what the trailer is actually showing, you know, with Hela and the way that whole just storyline is taking place in the trailer, it kind of matches a little bit more than, say, seeing it in a Suicide Squad trailer, where none of it really correlated with the music. It was just, oh, let's just throw that in there. And going back to Guardians of the Galaxy, the trailer seemed to just really emphasize the fun that the film was going to have, which was, you know, correlated with the music that was playing. So you can see that Marvel really knows how to market a film, just plainly, when it comes to utilizing music and rock music that kind of goes back in terms of the demographic utilizing it.
I think, too, one of the things that was really refreshing and compelling about that first trailer for Guardians and was paid off in the film, because a lot of times trailers make promises, and then when you go see the movie, the movie itself breaks the promise that was made in the trailer, and yes, nothing is more disappointing than that, especially when you're rooting for whatever it was that you liked in the trailer. And then you learn, like, oh, all the good parts were in the trailer.
Right.
Yeah.
And the rest of the movie was really not that good. Or, you know, tonally, I think one of the things that this trailer did and the movie paid it off was tonally, it had that attitude, that start to finish kind of strut around. And they're all cheeky with each other, but in a camaraderie kind of cheekiness.
Right.
Not like I'm actually insulting you all the time and want you to curl up into a fetal position
right.
and cry.
Yeah, it was kind of like, so take the, I forget at the end of which Marvel movie it was, but you know the little 15-second clips at the end of Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was the one where they were all was it after shawarma? Yes, yeah, that one. It was like the banter that they were having there, but in an entire movie. Just throughout. It was that kind of banter that everyone loved and wanted to see more of. The amount of people that said, I would watch an entire movie of the Avengers just sitting around eating shawarma together. Mm-hmm. And, but that's what Guardians of the Galaxy is. It's so kind of lighthearted, but has a great storyline in it that I actually forgot until I rewatched it how sad the beginning was. I had just completely erased that from my mind because all I remembered was the soundtrack. All I remembered were the funny banter scenes and everything like that. I had completely forgot how the beginning of the movie was. In fact, I was sitting there watching it. I was like, is this the right movie? Am I watching the right one? And then it got into it. I was like, all right, there we are.
I will say, I love that you bring up rewatching it because we also rewatched it over the weekend and happened to watch the 4K version essentially from the Vudu app on the television, and there are details in those shots that I've never seen before on the big screen or the small screen. It's so much more colorful. There's more contrast. There's more
brightness,
like depth of field, and you can see things way in the back. And I mean, it's amazing when you get a truly high quality video presentation format, and you watch that thing. I can't wait to see the new one. Specifically on my television at home someday, because you know that they did that and then
which
some.
Chad is not condoning pirating. He's just talking about when the film comes out on Blu-ray. That
I do it right. I do it right. These people work hard on this stuff, and they deserve all. And I'm talking like behind the scenes people.
Oh, yeah.
In addition to the names that you know.
Oh yeah, of course.
I mean, thousands of people on some of these big budget films, so they deserve it.
Oh yeah, and that's definitely one thing that we make sure people are aware. We're very much aware of all the people behind the scenes as well as those that are in front of the camera because, you know, just five people in front of the camera, they can't make a whole film. You need everybody on staff.
You'd have Bradley Cooper in a unitard with little, like, reference diodes or whatever they are on his body speaking like an angry raccoon, but you wouldn't know what to do with it.
Like an angry New Yorker in the body of a raccoon.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's another thing that, you know, for me was unique about the film. So I kind of mentioned Chris Pratt a little bit, but the entire casting for this film was very unique. Never in my wildest dreams prior to 2014 would I have said Chris Pratt and Dave Bautista would make a great movie. I don't think I would ever have said that. I don't think anybody would have been
Dave
able to
Bautista
say
Dave Bautista had done what in film?
Nothing.
Before Guardians?
Like,
I mean,
a ton of straight-to-DVD movies. And he did. So I was watching a interview this past week with, it's called Ask Men or something on YouTube. And they did an interview with Dave Bautista.
The Dispatch?
I think
a lot of their videos are branded as, you know, the Ask Men Dispatch.
Ah, okay. There you go. Well,
Product placement.
I was watching the interview, and he was like, you know, honestly, Dave Bautista was telling him when it came to the first film, he's like, I hadn't really done anything major up until I did Riddick. And then I did Riddick, and the casting coach, or the acting coach that had brought him on stayed with him after the film and began coaching him on just being more of a method actor, being more involved in what he's, you know, supposed to be portraying on film and everything. And it was eventually through that guy that he was able to nab the role for Drax. And so it's interesting to see, you know, this guy coming from just being this jock from wrestling to try to make that transition over to acting. And it doesn't always pan out. I mean, you look at a lot of the people who were previously in wrestling who tried to make that jump and just didn't land.
That usually doesn't work out.
Like, unless you're going to a studio who's just looking to find a cash grab, a quick cash grab, which that's all Hulk Hogan was during the late 80s, early 90s. You know, and then you look at like people like Macho Man Randy Savage, who had one film credit when it came to the first Spider-Man.
Hey, Andre the Giant nailed it. In The Princess Bride.
True.
All right.
True.
Nailed it.
But that was that might have been, you know, had, you know, rest in peace, Andre the Giant. But, you know, had he probably stayed alive.
And,
you know, well, had he not have passed away. is what I mean to say. I'm pretty sure he probably would have had more opportunities because he was really great in his role. And
yeah, but I mean, it's not, you wouldn't need a lot of versatility from somebody like him. And similarly, you don't necessarily need a lot of versatility, especially in this movie, from Dave Bautista. I mean, yeah, his character is a literalist. So he basically just sits there and says exactly what he thinks, and he redirects other people's snarky commentary and everything, and he doesn't understand all of it because yep, he's so literal, and that's what's yeah, funny. He doesn't need to have, the only thing he needs is comedic timing for saying the line.
Yeah.
And even that could, I mean, I think he did a great job, but also something like that could be somewhat manufactured in the editing process too.
True. Like, okay, he needed to wait a little bit, yeah, and then like deliver the
give
line.
Give him a little pause, or yeah, you know, or make it happen a little faster or whatever. But still, I mean, he did a terrific job. He's very watchable.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But seeing him on screen, like, he was one of my favorite wrestlers, so I actually enjoyed him when he was doing wrestling. But to see him actually translate on screen and actually produce a good product, a good performance, that's, you know, it's almost like, oh, hey, cool, I remember growing up and watching this guy, and now I'm seeing him actually do something successful outside of wrestling. It's fun to see. And vice versa on that same mindset with what we were talking about with Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper had done just a bunch of rom-coms as opposed to, like, the one maybe action film that he did with the A-Team.
No, he was a pretty established movie star by the time 2014 rolled around. That I think the interesting thing for Bradley Cooper was having him do voice work and having this true, be the voice that he right, does. Like, you wouldn't know. Like, if you just had to listen to the audio for Rocket's vocal
mm-hmm,
and say, who did that voice? I don't think in a million years most people would ever think Bradley Cooper.
True.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, people knew him at that point from, like, Silver Linings Playbook, and even he was in American Hustle and a few other things, or The Hangover.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know there were so many different parts of The Hangover, apparently.
It's like four or five yeah, parts now.
Well, he and Zoe Saldana had recently, before Guardians, done the words.
Yes. Mm. But people knew him in varied roles, but to think of just his voice, he doesn't have a recognizable voice like that.
No.
Where you just are like, oh yeah, he could totally voice over something. There are certain actors and actresses with specific tones and specific voices that you're like, yes, I could listen to anything that they do and totally enjoy it. Mm-hmm. He's not one of those.
No.
But totally fit for this specific role as Rocket.
Yeah.
And I would have never thought of that.
And I think for me, when I think of Bradley Cooper as an actor, I think of him more as a presence as opposed to, you know, him actually, you know, being eloquent when he talks. Like when I see him, I see him there as the, you know, not stand-in, but the role of this pretty boy, this, or this person who has this slick look, or this person who, someone who plays that type of role. So to see him transition, like you said, into voice acting, it's true. I probably wouldn't have guessed it either. I probably would have guessed somebody else who actually has a history of voice acting, because it sounds like somebody who has the whole methodology down of creating a solid voice for a character that he's not physically there to be. You know, so
yeah, I think that it's interesting when the cast was first announced
mm-hmm,
in terms of the main five, the Guardians themselves. The only one that made sense was Zoe Saldana, because
yes,
she had been Neytiri in Avatar. So she'd already, like, had the whole, like, I'm an alien
mm-hmm,
being and I'm a warrior and all that. Like, there was some continuity there.
Yeah.
She's green instead of blue, and it's actually her instead of motion capture her.
Well, and but she was in Star Trek.
Well, true, as yeah,
another alien. Yeah. She's really into just being different
she's
colors.
She's just used to being weird. But then you also take her physical ability from movies like Colombiana,
yes,
where she does a superb job yeah, in every scene
and movie.
You put all those together and you have the makings of somebody who can not only talk the talk but also walk the walk as an assassin warrior in the film. And I just think she makes for a great combination for that role,
mm-hmm,
which is why, who was it? They had said they had someone else in mind for the role, and it was between her and Zoe Saldana. It was talks after the fact.
Sure. Well, and it's interesting because, I mean, you look at it and like, she made sense. And then you're saying Chris Pratt, question mark, what? Mm. Bradley right. Cooper, question mark, huh, what?
Yeah.
As a raccoon? Dave Bautista acts? And, you know, Vin Diesel.
I mean, he acts.
Right?
He had to do something on wrestling.
You know, also doing only voiceover work. Obviously, many people know that he was the Iron Giant.
Yeah.
And know that he does vocal work and he's good at it. But he's such an established action film star that to cast him in a movie and not physically use him, even that was a question mark for people.
Yeah.
It was a lot of risks.
It's a character that says one thing repeatedly.
One phrase.
And it's interesting because with what we've talked about recently about Vin Diesel, he's very much about his own appearance and whatever he's doing.
Sure.
So when it comes to this particular role, I almost was certain that he was going to do some type of physical appearance in the film. Needless to say, seeing him as just a tree with Vin Diesel's voice, because it's almost like with Vin Diesel's grit and growl, there was no need for any kind of audio manipulation for his voice. Because it sounds literally like he could have said that same line and it would have sounded the same in the Fast and the Furious movie we saw. That probably would have made
Toretto.
That would have made the movie a ton better.
That would have transformed the movie right there.
I would have just been more engaged just to wait for the next time he says that line in the film.
Hater.
But yeah.
No, I know I am too.
Well, so Groot is one of those characters that I never thought before that I would like. I mean, he's a tree. And
he's a tree.
He was endearing to me because I love the Ents from Lord of the Rings, and he reminded me of a happier, nicer version of one of them, like a nicer cousin of theirs. And even though he only said one phrase.
I was going to say, the cousin who only says one phrase.
He didn't get to go to school like the other Ents. Okay, it's fine. But he only had one phrase that he said, but he had some of the most depth in his character, in the progression of the entire story.
Absolutely.
And he was so completely endearing. And the way that they did his facial expressions, the comedic timing that they had with his facial expressions when he, you know, pulled the battery off of the wall and the prison starts going crazy and he just looks over and raises it up and has the most endearing, like, smile on his face that they created for him, became quickly one of my favorite characters in the entire movie. And he didn't speak anything but three words. And I've never had that kind of experience except for WALL-E, the Disney Pixar movie, where he didn't speak at all. Just sounds and everything like that. And it was a very similar effect for me, where it was all the depth of the story and the content of it and what they did with the facial expressions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, moving on, another unique aspect of the film that kind of lends itself to the success of the film, the script. You know, one of the things that we talked about in this film, about this film, was how the timing of the humor, how just well-placed quips and lines and so forth made this film stand out in terms of other Marvel films. You know, you were saying about, you know, creating lines for Drax the Destroyer that were so deadpan that it was like, oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Making, you know, humor out of the awkward moments where, you know, you got people bringing legs and talking about, you know, oh, I need his eye and stuff like that. And you know the joke. And between you and Rocket and Chris Pratt's character, Star-Lord, you guys know the joke. And it's kind of like awkward, like, wait, does he really need the eye and so forth? A lot of those jokes, a lot of that.
Or it'll go over your head. Nothing goes over my head. I can jump too high, or whatever it is that he says.
My reflexes are too fast.
Yeah, my reflexes are too
fast. I will catch it.
It's so funny. But, you know, I think personally, as, you know, you both are aware that I've done screenwriting exercises before. I've made, you know, different scripts for different things. I find comedy to be incredibly difficult to do well on paper. Now, if you have a talented person kind of riffing and doing some improv to, I don't know, just try different approaches and find what works, then it helps. But I think a lot of this stuff was funny on paper already.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's not easy to do.
I watched a couple of interviews where they said the table read was hilarious. Yeah. And to be able to have a table read where there's no, you know, fancy things. You're just a bunch of people sitting around a table looking at pieces of paper, speaking out the words, to have that be so funny is a true testament to the script.
Absolutely.
And the people that wrote it, because a lot of the script really felt like it was you hanging out with friends and going on an adventure, and you were a part of the inside jokes that they were a part of, and they were endearing, and you were all just going through this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you look at it, who's the writer, James Gunn is one of the key writers for the script. And looking at his previous films like Slither, Slither has a lot of those deadpan moments where the humor is so awkward that it's just, it's funny. And so like this, he uses that same method to create the humor for this one. Like I was thinking while we were talking, another funny moment that I actually thought was hilarious, but I'm pretty sure at the time when it's happening in the film, it's not as, but like when they're looking at one of the Infinity Stones and what it can do, and then you got Star-Lord who's like, I just peed a little. And it's mm-hmm. it's like the delivery of it is what makes it funny, but the fact that it's actually in there and they're making pee jokes, you know, in a Marvel film that's supposed to, you know, stand up with the best of them, I find it hilarious. You know, it's the immature person in me, but it's like, oh yeah,
it is funny. I mean, not for everyone, but for most people, it is funny to have that kind of, because it's that. Who would have the wherewithal to say something like that in a moment like that? Like, who would do that?
But as soon as, coming from Chris Pratt and Parks and Rec, as soon as you put him in that environment, it makes complete sense. Like, you couldn't picture anyone else, because he was very similar of a character in Parks and Rec. I mean, really, it's just who Chris Pratt is in real life. So he's less playing a character in any of these and more just kind of being a more boisterous version of himself. But like, once you saw him in that role delivering those lines, you really couldn't picture anyone else doing that. And it just fit so perfectly.
Yeah, it's because it's funny. I was never a fan of the show, Parks and Rec. I knew he was on it. So after the movie came out, I'm like, oh yeah, he's pretty funny. You go back and look through like the season bloopers, and 90% of all the bloopers are him.
Right.
Because he says something that's so funny that everybody has to stop because they're laughing so hard that they can't keep the scene going.
Yep.
So it's, I guess, in combination with having somebody who is very flexible and can, on the spur of the moment, throw down some improv with what's given, a lot of that is also, you know, based on where the source of the script is coming from, which is from, you know, James Gunn, who wrote it.
He revised it. There was a script already before he was attached to it, and then he did his element. They're making a big deal about the fact, you know, the volume 2, the second film, that script, he wrote the whole thing start to finish. So it's much more on his shoulders to not go too far into quirky land, which he has a tendency to like to do. I don't remember who did the original. Well, it wasn't probably even the original draft. These kinds of scripts for multi-million dollar films go through like sometimes 40 or 50 writers before it's considered greenlit. And you don't know who hardly any of them were because it's somebody who's good at the quippy comments, and then somebody who's good at writing some quick exposition so that you can explain, well, why did I do that in as few words as possible, but it still makes sense. You know, like you get people who really specialize in certain attributes of characterization or action or whatever. And then once you have all those elements blended and working pretty well, then you've got a shooting script that the director comes on board and the actors and other people will still make some changes and things too. So I don't know at what stage of the writing process James Gunn became involved, but it did not originate with him, although clearly his mark is all over the movie.
And speaking of James Gunn, you know, that also goes into another aspect of the unique quality of the film, which is the director. James Gunn wasn't really known for doing anything prior to this film. Maybe he did a writing segment for like the Scooby-Doo movie, or maybe he did something for some low-budget, you know, horror-slash-comedy film like Slither. He didn't really have a big, you know, catalog of saying, okay, so this is my experience with big, big-budget films and being a director. So coming into this, I mean, I'm pretty sure this was one of those types of things where it's like, all right, we're giving pretty much right off of the Thor 2 debacle, We gave James Gunn, whom doesn't really have that much of a high quality type of film repertoire, one of our films that we're hoping can branch out and become a major piece of the franchise puzzle. And needless to say, I mean, obviously he hit it out of the park. But I actually wasn't aware that he was only partial writer of the script for Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
They
were talking about the movie several years before it was greenlit, so there had to have been versions of the story. Again, I don't know how much of it he might have personalized or, you know, customized mm-hmm. to his style, but you know, he did not start with a blank page and create that original script all from a blank page. He was very influential in the casting decisions because he was attached pretty fairly early on,
yeah.
And he did not jump ship, as we've seen people from the distinguished competition do, The Flash, repeatedly. So, yeah, obviously, he was involved for a lot of the pre-production decisions and everything. But yeah, Volume 2, I mean, he did start with a blank page and wrote the whole thing. As far as what they've reported. But I think for him as a director, one of the things that was clear very early on, because, again, that was a decision that a lot of insiders sat there and scratched their heads and said, wait a minute, what? That guy? Why?
Yeah.
That doesn't, with that much money, that kind of a like high risk film, you're going to give it to that guy? Why? And I think very early on, the Marvel Studios brass, they had him doing interview after interview after whatever he wants to post on Facebook or other Instagram, whatever. Which he still does, like, tremendously. He over-delivers on fan dialogue and all that. And people love him for it. So very early on, they had him out there not just promoting the film, but talking about how much he loved the characters, the story, the environment, and all of it. I remember seeing concept art very early on that was the first time that you had a visual to go with the name Guardians of the Galaxy, and it was gorgeous. I mean, it looked like the best that Star Wars had to offer could also happen somewhere else too, visually speaking. You know, and it was quite unique.
True. And going back to what you were saying about social media, that I think that is one of the great defining things about James Gunn, is that he is such a director for the people, as opposed to,
I was
like,
just about to say the same thing.
You know, he's as much as he has to answer to the higher ups and everything, if he has an opportunity, he'll do an AMA on Facebook, or mm-hmm. he'll do, you know, something on Reddit, or he'll throw himself on Twitter and like throw out little snippets here and there, because he knows fans are out there and they're wanting to know information, and most of the time his hands are tied, but he'll still throw out some kind of nugget, like when he did that behind the scenes for Volume 2 not too long ago on Facebook, where he actually did a live video, Facebook Live, while they were doing the wrap-up. That's what it was for. It was for the wrap-up.
Right.
But he did a Facebook Live for that and was like all excited and, you know, having the fans respond and everything. So I think that's one of the great things that I think a lot of other directors should really jump on board with, and that's recognizing that the more and more you recognize the fact that the fans are out there and they want to be heard, and you can actually do some form of response to that, the more and more the fans are going to be willing to jump on board with whatever future projects you have in mind, especially if they're not in like a major franchise or major, you know, production studio like Disney or Marvel or, you know, things in that area. And I fervently believe if James Gunn was to say, oh, you know, by the way, I got this passion project I'd like to do somewhere down the road, and it's this, everybody who has seen what he's done with the Guardians of the Galaxy film so far, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, I definitely want to be on board with that, because I know he's going to show me stuff. He's going to let me see what's going on with the film.
Well, it's a matter of trust at that point. Like, who is actually going to make the film succeed or fail? It's going to be the fans. It's going to be the people. And so when you make direct connections with them, and you establish trust and this, you know, weird sort of relationship, mm-hmm. then they're willing to go support you, and they're willing to, in our modern day and age, retweet you and mm-hmm. share and post and like and all of that. They are willing to show their support in any and every way that they can,
yeah.
Which this day and age is exposure, which is huge for a director like him, mm-hmm. where he's maybe not as well known. And it was huge for a movie like this, where there were a lot of questions around it. But this kind of movie is kind of like what we talked about earlier, so refreshingly different from everything else. There are a couple other Marvel movies that do the same thing more recently, like this is questionable because a lot of people either love it or don't, but Ant-Man also did a very similar thing with its humor, mm-hmm. Its casting, people that you wouldn't expect, but that actually fit the roles really well. And Doctor Strange, the relationship between Doctor Strange and the Cape, they kind of took that, a few notes from these kind of movies, and did a very similar thing. And it wasn't just, you know, one comedic moment here and there like you see in the Captain America movies or Avengers or Iron Man or anything like that. It was a consistent thread of humor and of lightening the tone in very serious moments, which now that you're seeing that more and more in these kind of off the normal track Marvel movies, so the Doctor Stranges and the Guardians of the Galaxy and all that.
Yeah.
These are what people love. This is what endears people to these movies. These are the movies that people want to go back and watch over and over and over again because they enjoy it, because it's fun, because it's lighthearted, and it makes them feel good. It doesn't just excite them because there's a bunch of explosions and people doing cool tricks. It's that they feel like they're hanging out with friends. And that's part of one of the biggest things that makes this movie and this whole series stand out from the rest.
It's true.
Well, I think that when you have a property like Guardians or, like you mentioned, Ant-Man or Doctor Strange, in a very real way, the filmmakers have to work harder. It's not a sure thing. I mean, even the first Captain America movie, they weren't sure because it was set in World War II. It was not modern-day Captain America. It was... Right. His origin story, and they weren't sure. They hired the director from The Rocketeer and hoped that it was going to work, you know, but they weren't sure. But even more so with a property like this, well, we see a lot of potential in it, but will the fan community, will they support it at all? And so, and I think you can really see, you can see the movie working harder than other origin stories. Or even the first Avengers film. There's a lot to love about the other origin stories, the Avengers, you know, the first Avengers film. But I was, you know, in watching it again over the weekend, it was remarkable how much typically in a big budget, you know, blockbuster type movie nowadays, everything that's important is in the foreground. Either in the exact dialogue that they're spitting out at you right there from the character in front of the screen, or just putting kind of a moving backdrop behind them, but not having anything important happening back there. And in this film, you've got things like Groot going after a battery in the background. That is an A storyline action happening.
Right.
And you have the delight of seeing what the characters in front of you in the foreground don't even see is happening.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the quippy little asides that they do with their words that, you know, I think I just peed a little or whatever.
Yeah.
Where it's not.
Do you need to go to the bathroom?
Maybe. It's not the storytelling part. It's not the, like, you killed my family and now I want to avenge them part for, you know, like, it's not all of those things. It's all this extra flavor that's in there. Mm-hmm. And it's just this movie, this film is permeated with flavor. And some of it you can disregard if you don't like it and still have a blast.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the film. If you're not too keen on Howard the Duck, then...
Don't watch the ending.
He's just over there in you know, the collector scene. Like, he's just over there in a cage.
Right. Yeah.
And then later on, you don't have to your point, you don't have to watch that cut scene at all.
Yeah.
And it's fine. But if you like that kind of thing, they went there and they put him in there, and that's kind of cool.
And DC needs to take notes from that and take a page out of that book. They take themselves too seriously. That's one of their issues. Seriously. Whereas you see films like this that become the people's favorite, and they markedly don't do that. They make sure that there are very somber, very serious scenes in there, and every character in Guardians of the Galaxy is dealing with very hard, very real issues, and it's part of why they're doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But they never take the craziness of life or these moments or the journey that they're on all too seriously. They don't take themselves too seriously. But DC, as a franchise and as individual films, they do. And I think that's one of their downfalls in this recent kind of reboot of their films.
And it's true, because it is something that any franchise who is rooted in joy and fun and pretty much wanting to bring just entertainment to the masses, when you start venturing into wanting to create big screen adaptations, you need to realize and recognize where your source material comes from. And one thing that Marvel has pretty much, you know, nailed into the books is they recognize that their source material are children's comics, ultimately. I mean, let's just be honest. Kids were the ones who were collecting these, and that same fandom grew into as people got older and so forth. But it's something that's supposed to be, you know, attractive to the eyes for all ages, not just grown-ups. You know, DC is not just a, you know, franchise of stories that's only for grown-ups. It's not just a franchise that's only for, you know, young adults. And same thing with Marvel. Marvel is not just geared for older, you know, people. It's not just geared for young adults and all that. It's geared so that everybody can have a time where they can enjoy it. And yes, there are certain storylines that may be a little bit more darker than others, but the overall premise of everything that they're doing is to bring enjoyment to the masses. And when you have a franchise that realizes or that doesn't realize where its roots come from, and you take yourself too seriously, then nobody will. You know, and that's just, it's not cool.
Well, you miss an opportunity.
Exactly.
It's not that the subject matter doesn't deserve to be dark. I mean, here, for example, you've got a warlord in service to a bigger super warlord coming to destroy a world full of people that has, as far as we know, been serving as a protective, peacekeeping kind of police state for other worlds and other people groups. Xandar, the homeworld of the Nova Corps.
Nova Corps, yeah.
It's a very cosmopolitan looking society, lots of different types of creatures from different, you know, areas of the cosmic side of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that are all welcome in this very brightly lit, very open, very peaceful looking community, clean water, clean streets, you know, whatever. And here comes Ronan wanting to murder them all, like genocide. That's all he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And that could easily be a very ominous, tonally very,
very
ominous
dark
film from start to finish, especially when you start with a sequence where young Peter Quill watches his mother die from cancer.
Right.
And then he gets kidnapped into outer space. But, I mean, that's not what they did at all. And I think, you know, that opening sequence is a perfect example. You know, you go from that really intense, like heart-wrenching moment, and then you go straight into a fun song. He's grown up. He's dancing around, kicking these weird alien rodent
things.
Using
them as microphones to sing.
Know? Yeah, I mean, like, it does this tonal shift very quickly, and you realize, oh, this is not going to be dreary.
Right.
It's not going to be humdrum.
Yeah.
I might actually enjoy this thing.
Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, great, you know, script writing for keeping the well pace of the film itself and knowing, you know what, if we keep it too monotone with that darker, ominous feel, then people are going to check out early.
Mm-hmm.
And how it breaks it up is it's really well done in breaking up all of those scenes all the way up to the end of the film. You know, you have all these different opportunities where the film could honestly just go really south really fast. You know, especially when you get right into that final third act at the tail end where Ronan actually makes it on, you know, on the planet and he's about to commit mass genocide and, you know, take everybody out. And what do? You got a dance off between.
Dance off, bro.
You know, and I mean, honestly, who would have thought that at the moment when the hero really needs to show up, the hero really needs to jump in there and really, you know, save the day, as Captain America would or Iron Man would or whomever. And what does the hero, quote, hero, do in this scenario? he has a dance off. He begins to dance
against like a super bad guy,
yes, which who is super powerful. He just took out an entire fleet of ships in the middle of the air, and he's about to do it. It's so, mind you, I probably would have never in a million years would have been like, oh yeah, that would have made sense. If I would have, if I were reading it, I'm like, okay, and villain is about to commit mass genocide, and Star-Lord begins to dance. Like, wait, what?
But that's the best part of it, is that Star-Lord isn't a normal hero. So he's not Captain America, who would not have even thought to do that. That would not be in his mind. Even Iron Man, as kind of snarky as he is, wouldn't do that.
Would not have done a dance-off.
No, not at all. The beauty of who the character of Star-Lord is that that's the natural reaction for him. He's not the you know, typical hero, but he is a man for his people. Not necessarily for the people, but for his people, for his team. He is loyal no matter what, you know, people like to, what his, you know, Yondu or anyone likes to think. He is a very loyal guy to his team, even beyond just the money, which is why repeatedly he goes and saves people in the film for more than just, you know, risking his own life for those reasons. But a part of that is how they used the music in the entire film was so refreshing and so new in comparison to any other films that it really caught the attention of so many people. And that kind of collection of songs that they used for the various artists' album just like caught wind, and it took off, became one of the most popular playlists all across all music billboards and everything like that for multiple weeks straight. It was crazy because even though most people had heard most of these songs before, they wanted this kind of whole album and this experience because of the film. They wanted this again. And it was incredible how they did that.
Oh, and the film uses the songs. Like, yes, they're part of the narrative. So when you hear the song, you think of that part of the movie.
Yeah.
Right.
It wasn't just an instance where, okay, we'll throw these in the trailer and then maybe we may have one in the film. But, you know, which going back to other franchises who have tried to emulate that same formula for trailers, it is. It's just peppered throughout this entire film with songs that actually relate to the circumstances or the scenes that they're in. Like, one that comes to mind is the dancing song between Peter Quill and Gamora, where he's telling her the story of Kevin Bacon and the people who have sticks up their butts, you know, and she puts the headphones on and she starts dancing, but the song is appropriate for the scene, and it's funny, and so, yeah, I mean, the music for this particular film, I don't think I've ever seen a film recently, and I'm not just talking about Marvel, I'm talking about over in general, I don't think I've seen a film where the entire playlist was pretty much all films that were already produced and already done years before. Like, years.
All songs, yeah.
Yeah, all old classic songs. I don't think anybody had really done anything like that recently. I'm pretty sure someone made
it. Yeah, when it wasn't like a period film that was meant to be an 80s film or something.
And the actual score itself is not that remarkable. I mean, it's good, but it's a bunch of ethereal pads and very kind of, you know, the typical space celestial makes you feel things type, like just droning in the background. And a lot of them, I was watching through the scenes, it's the same pad used throughout. But then you break that up, and those were great for those scenes, but you break that up with these songs and the juxtaposition between that just worked flawlessly for this particular film.
Mm-hmm. So, in conclusion, I mean, obviously, we really enjoyed the film, and we really are looking forward to the sequel to this film. What are some of the things that you guys are really looking forward to specifically that, you know, maybe from you remember from the first film that might carry over, or maybe it's something new that you heard about and you're super excited for?
Oh, mine's easy. Baby Groot.
I was about to say the same thing. Baby Groot for me.
The second that they went that far in the mid-credits scene with him starting to come to life and dance, I mean, you had me at hello, Baby Groot. That was brilliant. Yeah. And to know that they modeled the CGI dance moves on things that James Gunn would actually do on set, Like, that was kind of his vibe sometimes. And
yeah.
They tried to capture that with Baby Groot. It just enriches the story even further. So the fact that they've still got a Baby Groot, this time in a little uniform running around.
Which is
like,
so
cute. But not
cute.
Knowing how to behave like a child wouldn't.
Right.
I think that I'm already sold.
Right. That, I think, so Baby Groot is definitely my top because I just love all things Groot. But also, I'm really looking forward to Drax's character development. Because at least in the trailer, I'm not sure about the actual movie itself, but he seems to be engaging more in kind of the dialogue in the team, and even in a joking sense, which I'm excited to see how that will look on a whole team level, but specifically with him.
Yeah.
For me, I know one of the things that I'm looking forward to is more the actual explanations as to where all the things went in the collector's, you know, room. We had talked about it that one time, how we were looking through everything in the collector's room, and one of the things that was in there looked like Beta Ray Bill. And
yeah, from behind or something.
Yeah, and there's just, I'm really wanting to see more of an appearance of characters that I remember from the comics appear in the movie. And, you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to see awesome
stuff.
Well,
I mean, with 5 cutscenes throughout the credits sequence, there's bound to be quite a lot of little nuggets sprinkled in there.
True. But that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Again, let us know your thoughts on this one on and drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmphilosophy101. I'm excited for this Thursday when we get a chance to go see it. Me and Chad are going to go see it at one theater. Hannah decided that she wanted to do her own thing and go and drive somewhere else.
Different
and
friends.
With different friends.
The other friends.
That aren't
film
philosophers.
I didn't know you guys were going out.
So,
you know, I want to give you guys your little date together, so I didn't want to intrude.
So, I can promise you this, that this crew is going to be here next Tuesday.
Absolutely.
And we will be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 for you. And we are excited. So, of course, like I said, let us know what you think of tonight's episode and check out all previous episodes on our website. Hannah, where can people find you at?
You can go to Instagram.com/HannahPorterMusic or find me on Facebook under the same thing.
Hannah Porter Music. Well, like I said, great episode, awesome conversation, and thank you again, Hannah, for showing up and being here
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely. Thanks for letting me be here.
From all of us here at The Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class.
I'm Groot.
Class dismissed.